calling to her lost child. And the duckling replied, squirming in Gisa's arms. Finally, you made Gisa give the little thing back. You are not a duck, Gisa, you said. You two don't belong together. And then you gave the duckling back to its mother and watched them all scramble away, ducks in a row, back to the river. I'm waiting to hear a point in all this. There is one, Cal murmurs, his voice reverberating deep in his chest. He sounds almost surprised. Killorn's eyes flicker to the prince, giving him the slightest nod of thanks. Nix and Ada are not ducklings, and you are certainly not their mother. They can handle themselves. Then he grins crookedly, falling back to his old jokes. You, on the other hand, look a bit worse for the wear. Don't I know it? I try to smile for him just a little, but something about smiling pulls the skin on my face, which in turn twists my neck and the new scars there. They ache when I speak, and smart terribly under any more strain. Another thing Maven has taken away. How happy it must make him to think I can no longer smile without searing pain. Farley and Shade are with them, at least? The boys nod in unison, and I almost giggle at the sight. They are normally like opposites. Killorn is lean, where Cal is burly. Killorn is golden-haired and green-eyed, while Cal is dark, with a gaze like living fire. But here, in the waning light, behind the film of blood clouding my gaze, they start to seem alike. Krantz, too, Cal adds. I blink, perplexed. Krantz? He's here? He's with us? Not like he had anywhere else to go, Cal says. And you trust him? Killorn leans against the wall, stuffing his hands in his pockets. He saved Ada, and he's helped bring back others in the past few days. Why shouldn't we trust him? Because he's a thief? Like me, like I was. Point taken. Even so, I can't forget the high cost of misplaced faith. But we can't be sure, can we? You're not sure of anyone, Killorn sighs, annoyed. He scuffs his shoe in the dirt, wanting to say more, knowing he shouldn't. He's out with Farley now. Not a bad scout, Cal adds in support. Of Killorn. I'm almost in shock. Are you two agreeing on something? What world am I waking up in? A true smile splits Cal's face, as well as Killorn's. He's not as bad as you make him out to be, Killorn says, nodding at the prince. Cal laughs, a soft noise tainted by all that came before. Likewise. I prod at Cal's shoulder just to make sure he's solid. I guess I'm not dreaming. Thank my colors you're not. Cal murmurs, his smile gone again. He runs a hand along his jaw, scratching through a slim beard. He hasn't shaved since Archaon, since the night he watched his father die.
Ada's more useful than the outlaws, if you can believe it.
I can.
A swirl of abilities flashes through my mind, each one more powerful than the last.
What does she do?
Nothing I've ever seen before, he admits.
His bracelet crackles, throwing off sparks that soon turn into a twisting ball of flame. It idles in his hand a moment, never burning his sleeve, before he lazily tosses it to the small pit dug in the middle of the floor. The fire throws off heat and light, replacing the setting sun.
She's smart, incredibly so. Remembers every word in every book in the governor's library.
And just like that, my vision of another warrior is snuffed out.
Helpful, I bite out. I'll be sure to ask her to tell us a story later on.
Told you she wouldn't get it, Killorn says.
But Cal presses on.
She has perfect memory, perfect intelligence. Every moment of every day, every face she's ever seen, every word she's ever overheard, she remembers. Every medical journal or history book or map she's ever read, she understands. The same goes for practical lessons, too.
As much as I'd prefer a storm wielder, I can understand the value of a person like this. If only Julian was here. He'd spend day and night studying Ada, trying to understand such a strange ability.
Practical lessons? You mean like training?
Something like pride crosses Cal's face.
I'm no instructor, but I'm doing what I can to teach her. She's already a pretty decent shot.
And she finished the Black Run flight manual this morning. A gasp escapes my lips.
She can fly the jet?
Cal shrugs, lips curling into a smirk.
She flew the others to Concorda, and should be back soon.
But until then, you should rest.
I've rested for 4 days. You rest, I fire back, reaching over to shake his shoulder. He doesn't budge under my admittedly weak shove.
You both look like the walking dead.
Someone had to make sure you kept breathing.
Killorn's tone is light, and another might think him joking, but I know better.
Whatever Maven did to you can't happen again.
The memory of white-hot pain is still too near for me. I can't help but flinch at the thought of going through it once more.
I agree.
It sobers us all, the thought of what new power Maven holds. Even Killorn, always twitching or pacing, is still. He glares out the window, at the wall of oncoming night.
Cal, you got any ideas in case she runs into that thing again?
If I'm going to get a lecture, I might need some water, I say, suddenly aware of my parched throat.
Killorn all but jumps from his place at the wall, eager to help, leaving me alone with Cal, and the heat closing in.
I think it was a sounder device. Modified, of course,
Cal says. His eyes stray back to my neck, to the lightning bolt scars marching up and down my spine. With shocking familiarity, he traces them again, as if they hold some clue. The intelligent part of me wants to push him away, to stop the fire prince from examining my brands, but exhaustion and need overrule any other thoughts. His touch is soothing, physically and emotionally. It's proof that someone else is with me. I am not alone in the abyss anymore.
We dabbled with sounders on the lakes a few years ago. They spit out radio waves and wreaked havoc with the Lakelander ships, made it impossible for them to communicate with each other. But it did the same to us. Everyone had to sail blind.
His fingers trail lower, following one gnarled branch of scar tissue across my shoulder blade.
I suppose this one throws off electrical waves, or static, in great magnitude.
Enough to incapacitate you, to make you blind, and turn your lightning against you.
They built it so quickly. It's only been a few days since the Bowl of Bones.
I murmur back. Anything louder than a whisper might shatter this fragile piece.
Cal's hand stills, his palm flat against my bare skin.
Maven turned against you long before the Bowl of Bones.
I know that now. I know it with every bleeding breath.
Something releases in me, breaking, bending my back so I can bury my face in my hands. Whatever wall I put up to keep the memories out is steadily crumbling into dust. But I can't let it bury me. I can't let the mistakes I've made bury me.
When Cal's warmth wraps around me, his arms around my shoulders, his head tucked against my neck, I lean into him. I let him protect me.
Though we swore we wouldn't do this back in the cells of Tuck, we are nothing more than distractions for each other, and distractions get you killed. But my hands close over his, our fingers lacing, until our bones are woven together. The fire is dying, flames reduced to embers, but Cal is still here. He will never leave me.
What did he say to you?
He whispers. I draw back a little, so he can see. With a shaking hand, I pull on the collar of my shirt, showing him what Maven did. His eyes widen when they land on the brand. A ragged M burned into my skin. For a long time, he stares, and I fear his anger might set me on fire again.
He said he was a man of his word, I tell him.
The words are enough to draw his gaze away from my newest scar.
That he would always find me and save me.
I bark out an empty laugh, The only person Maven has to save me from is himself. With gentle hands, Cal pulls my shirt back into place, hiding his brother's mark.
We knew that already. At least now we truly know why.
Hmm?
Maven lies as easily as he breathes.
And his mother holds his leash, but not his heart.
Cal's eyes widen, imploring me to understand.
He's hunting new bloods not to protect his throne, but to hurt you. To find you. To make you come back to him.
His fist clenches on his thigh.
Maven wants you more than anything else on this earth.
Would that Maven were here now so I could rip out his horrible, haunting eyes.
Well, he can't have me. I realize the consequences of this, and so does Cal.
Not even if it stops the killing? Not for the new bloods?
Tears bite my eyes.
I won't go back. For anyone.
I expect his judgment, but instead he smiles and ducks his head, ashamed of his own reaction as I am of mine.
I thought we would lose you.
His words are deliberately chosen, carefully made. So I lean forward, putting a hand on his fist. It's all the assurance he needs to press on.
I thought I was going to lose you. So many times.
But I'm still here, I say. He takes my neck in his hands like he doesn't believe me. I'm dimly reminded of Maven's grip, but fight the urge to flinch. I don't want Cal to pull away. I have been running for so long, since before all this even started. Even back in the stilts, I was a runner, avoiding my family, my fate, anything I didn't want to feel. And I am still racing now, from those who would kill me and those who would love me. I want so badly to stop. I want to stand still without killing myself or someone else. But that is not possible. I must keep going. I must hurt myself to save myself, hurt others to save others, hurt Killorn, hurt Cal, hurt Shade and Farley and Nyx, and everyone stupid enough to follow me. I'm making them runners too.
So we fight him.
Cal's lips move closer, hot with each word. His grip tightens, like any second someone is going to come and take me from him.
That's what we set out to do, so we do it. We build an army, and we kill him. Him and his mother both.
Killing a king will change nothing. Another will take his place. But it is a start. If we cannot outrun Maven, we must stop him cold. For the new bloods, for Cal, for me. I am a weapon made of flesh, a sword covered in skin. I was born to kill a king, to end a reign of terror before it can truly begin. Fire and lightning raised Maven up, and fire and lightning will bring him down.
I won't let him hurt you again.
His breath makes me shiver, a strange sensation when surrounded with such blazing warmth.
I believe you, I tell him, lying.
Because I am weak, I turn in his arms. Because I am weak, I press my lips to his, searching for something to make me stop running, to make me forget.
We are both weak, it seems.
As his hands run over my skin, I feel a different sort of pain, worse than Maven's machine, deeper than my nerves. It aches like a hollow, like an empty weight. I am a sword, born of lightning, of this fire, and of Maven's. One already betrayed me, and the other might leave at any moment. But I do not fear a broken heart. I do not fear pain. I cling to Cal, Killorn, Shade, to saving all the new bloods I can, because I am afraid of waking up to emptiness, to a place where my friends and family are gone, and I am nothing but a single bolt of lightning in the blackness of a lonely storm. If I am a sword, I am a sword made of glass, and I feel myself beginning to shatter.
18.
The thing with heat is,
No matter how cold you are, no matter how much you need warmth, it always eventually becomes too much. I remember many winters spent with the window cracked open, letting in the blistering cold to combat the fire burning in the family room below. Something about the icy air helped me sleep. And now deep gasps of an autumn breeze help me to calm down, help me forget Cal alone back in the safe house. I should not have done that, I think, pressing a hand to my fevered skin. He is not only a distraction I can't afford, but a heartbreak waiting to happen. His allegiances are shaky, at best. One day he will leave, or die, or betray me, like so many others have. One day, he will hurt me. Overhead, the sun has completely set, painting the sky in darkening streaks of red and orange. Maybe. I can't trust the colors I see. I can't trust in much of anything anymore. The safe house is built into the crest of a hill, in the middle of a large clearing surrounded by forest. It overlooks a winding valley full of trees, lakes, and constant swirling mist. I grew up in the woods, but this place is as alien to me as Archaeon, or the Hall of the Sun. There's nothing man-made as far as the eye can see. No echo of a logging village or farm town. Though I suppose there's a runway hidden nearby, if the jet can still be used. We must be deep into the Norton backcountry, north and inland from Harbor Bay. I don't know the region's state well, but this looks like the Great Woods region, dominated by wilderness, rolling green mountains, and a frozen tundra border with the Lakelands. It's sparsely populated, gently governed by the shivers of House Glyakon, and a marvelous place to hide. You finished with him? Killorn is little more than a shadow, leaning against the trunk of an oak with sky-splayed branches. There's a water jug forgotten by his feet. I don't need to see his face to know he's upset. I can hear it just fine. Don't be unkind. I'm used to ordering him around, but this sounds like a request. As I expected, he ignores me and keeps rambling. I guess all rumors do have a grain of truth. Even the ones that little snit Maven spits out. Mayor Barrow seduced the prince into killing the king. It's shocking to know he's half right. He takes a few prowling steps forward, reminding me very much of an Eral Silk creeping in for a final blow. Because the prince is most certainly bewitched. If you keep talking, I'm going to turn you into a battery. You should get some new threats, he says, smiling sharply. He's gotten used to my big talk over the years, and I doubt I could scare him with anything, even my lightning. He's a powerful man, in every form of the word, don't get me wrong. I'm glad you're holding his reins. I can't help but scoff aloud, laughing in his face. Glad? You're jealous, plain and simple. You're not used to sharing. And you don't like being useless. Useless. The word stings. I can tell by the twitch in his neck. But it doesn't stop him from towering over me, his height blocking out the stars winking to life above us. The question is, are you under a spell too? Is he using you the same way you're using him? I'm not using anyone. A lie, and we both know it. And you don't know what you're talking about. You're right, he says quietly. Surprise almost knocks me off my feet. In more than 10 years of friendship, I have never heard those words from Killorn Warren. He's stubborn as a tree stump, too self-assured for his own good, a smarmy bastard most of the time, but now, on this hilltop, he is nothing he ever was. He seems small and dim, a glimmer of my old life steadily flickering into nothing. I clasp my hands together to keep from reaching out and touching him, to prove that Killorn still exists. I don't know what happened to you when you were Marina. I wasn't there to help you through that. I won't tell you that I understand or that I'm sorry for you. That's not what you need. But it's exactly what I want, so I can be angry with him.
so I don't have to listen to what he's about to say. Too bad Killorn knows me better than that.
The best thing I can do is tell you the truth. Or at least, what I think is the truth.
Though his voice is steady, his shoulders rise and fall with deep, heaving breaths.
He's scared.
It'll be up to you to believe me or not.
A twitch pulls at my lips, betraying a painful smile. I'm so used to being pushed and pulled, manipulated into thinking and doing by those closest to me. Even Killorn is guilty of that. But now he's giving me the freedom I've wanted for so long. A choice, small as it may be. He trusts that I have the sense to choose, even if I don't.
I'm listening.
He starts to say something else, then stops himself. The words stick, refusing to come out. And for a second, his green eyes look strangely wet.
What, Killorn? I sigh.
What?
He echoes, shaking his head. After a long second, something snaps in him.
I know you don't feel the same way I do. About us.
I'm seized by the urge to smash my head against a rock.
Us? It feels stupid to talk about. A foolish waste of time and energy.
But more than that, it's embarrassing and uncomfortable. My cheeks flame red. This is not a conversation I ever wanted to have with him.
And that's fine. He presses on before I can stop him. You never saw me the way I see you. Not even at home, before all this happened.
I thought you might, one day. But...
He shrugs his shoulders.
It's just not in you to love me.
When I was Mayor Barrow of the Stilts, I thought the same way. I wondered what would happen if I survived conscription, and saw what that future held. A friendly marriage to the fish boy with green eyes. Children we could love. A poor stilt home. It seemed like a dream back then. An impossibility. And it still is. It always will be. I do not love Killorn. Not the way he wants me to. I never will.
Killorn, I murmur, taking a step toward him. But he takes two back.
Killorn, you're my best friend. You're like family.
His smile bleeds sadness.
And I will be, until the day I die.
I do not deserve you, Killorn Warren.
I'm sorry.
I choke out, not knowing what else I can say. I don't even know what I'm apologizing for.
It's not something you can control, Mayor.
He replies, still standing so far away.
We can't choose who we love.
I wish, more than anything, that we could. I feel cracked open. My skin still runs hot from Cal's embrace, remembering the feel of him only moments ago. But in the deepest part of me, in spite of every fiber of my being, I think beyond the clearing, to ice-colored eyes, an empty promise, and a kiss aboard a boat.
You can love him all you want, I won't stop you. But for my sake, for your parents, for the rest of us, please don't let him control you.
Again, I think of Maven. But Maven is far away, a shadow on the sharp edges of the world. He might be trying to kill me, but he can't control me, not anymore.
Killorn can only mean the other royal brother, the fallen son of House Kalor.
Cal.
My shield against the scars and the nightmares. But he's a warrior, not a politician or a criminal. He doesn't have the ability to manipulate anyone, least of all me. It's just not in his nature.
He's Silvermare. You don't know what he's capable of or what he really wants.
I doubt Cal does either. The exiled prince is even more adrift than I am, without any allegiance or allies beyond a temperamental lightning girl.
He's not what you think he is, I say, no matter what color his blood may be.
A sneer razors across his face, thin and sharp.
You don't really believe that.
I don't believe, I say, sadly.
I know.
And it makes everything harder.
Once, I thought blood was the world entire, the difference between dark and light, an irrevocable, impassable divide. It made the Silvers powerful and cold and brutal, inhuman compared to my red brethren. They were nothing like us, unable to feel pain or remorse or kindness. But people like Cal, Julian, and even Lucas have shown me how wrong I was. They are just as human, just as full of fear and hope. They are not without their sins, but neither are we. Neither am I. If only they were the monsters Killorn believes them to be. If only things were that simple. Quietly, in the deepest part of my heart, I envy Killorn's narrow anger. I wish I could share in his ignorance, but I've seen and suffered too much for that. We're going to kill Maven, and his mother, I add with chilling assurance. Kill the ghost, kill the shadow. If they die, the new bloods will be safe. And Cal will be free to reclaim his throne, to make everything as it was. That won't happen. No one would let him back on the throne, red or silver. And from what I can tell, he doesn't want it. Really? I immediately hate the smirk twisting Killorn's lips. Whose idea was it? To kill Maven? When I don't answer, the smirk grows. That's what I thought. Thank you for your honesty, Killorn. My gratitude takes him aback, surprising him as much as he surprised me. We have both changed in the past few months, no longer the girl and boy from the stilts ready to tussle over any topic, and every topic. They were children, and they are gone forever. I'll keep what you said in mind, of course. My lessons have never felt so close, helping me know how to dismiss Killorn without hurting him, as a princess would a servant. But Killorn is not so easily cast aside. His eyes narrow into dark green slits, seeing right through my mask of courtesy. He looks so disgusted, I expect him to spit. One day soon, you're going to get lost. He breathes. And I won't be there to lead you back. I turn my back on my oldest friend. His words sting, and I don't want to hear them, no matter how much sense he makes. His boots crunch over the hard earth as he stalks off, leaving me to stand and stare at the woods. In the distance, an airjet hums, returning to us. I fear being alone more than anything else. So why do I do this? Why do I push away the people I love? What is so very wrong with me? I don't know. And I don't know how to make it stop. Gathering an army is the easy part. The records from Harbor Bay lead us to some new bloods in towns and villages across the Beacon region, from Cancorda to Taurus, to the half-flooded ports of the Barn Islands. Because of Julian's list, we expand out until every part of Nortes within our grasp, even Delphi, the southernmost city in the kingdom, is just a few hours away by jet. Every population center, no matter how small, has a new garrison of silver officers meant to catch us and turn us over to the king. But they can't guard every target at all times, and Maven is not yet strong enough in his reign to kidnap hundreds overnight. We strike randomly, without pattern, and we usually catch them off balance. Sometimes we get lucky, and they don't even know we're there at all. Shade proves his use time and again, as do Ada and Nyx. Her abilities help us find our way around city walls. His help us go right through them. But it always comes down to me. I am always the one to confront each new blood, to explain what they are and what kind of danger they pose to the king. Then they are given a choice, and they always choose to live. They always choose us. We give safe passage to their families, directing the ones left behind to the various sanctuaries and bases operated by the Scarlet Guard. To command, as Farley says, her words more cryptic every time. A few are even sent to Tuck Island to seek the safety of the Colonel. He might hate new bloods, but Farley assures me he won't turn away true reds. The new bloods we find are afraid, some angry,
but a few are surprised, usually the children. For the most part, they don't know what they are. But some do, and they are already haunted by the mutations of our blood. On the outskirts of the city of Haven, we meet Luther Carver, a young boy of 8, with wispy black hair, small for his age, the son of a carpenter. We find him in his father's workshop, excused from school to learn the trade. It takes very little convincing to get Mr. Carver to let us in, though he eyes Cal and even Nix with suspicion. And the boy refuses to look me in the eye, his tiny fingers twitching with nerves. He trembles when I speak to him and insists on calling me Lightning Girl. Your name is on this list because you are special, because you are different, I tell him. Do you know what I'm talking about? The boy shakes his head violently, his long bangs swiping to and fro. But his aptly named father stands like a guardian at his back. Solemnly, slowly, he nods his head. It's all right, Luther. It's nothing to be ashamed of. I reach across the table, past intricate designs that are certainly Carver's handiwork. But Luther's fingers ghost away from my touch, and he pulls his hands into his lap, squirming out of my reach. It's nothing personal, Carver says, putting a soothing hand on his son's shoulder. Luther's not. He just doesn't want to cause you any harm. It comes and goes. It's getting worse, you see. But you're going to help him, aren't you? The poor man sounds pained, his voice cracking. My heart goes out to him, and I wonder what my father would be like in such a position, faced by people who understand your child, who can help, but must take him away from you. You know why he is this way? It's a question I've asked myself many times, a question almost every new blood asks of me. But still, I have no answer. I'm sorry, but I don't, sir. We only know that our abilities come from a mutation, something in our blood that can't be explained. I think of Julian and his books, his research. He never got to teach me about the divide, the ancient moment when silver blood split from red, only that it happened and resulted in the world now. I suppose a new divide has begun, in blood like mine. He was studying me before his capture, trying to figure out the answer to this exact question, but he never got the chance. Cal shifts at my side, and when he rounds the table, I expect to see the intimidating mask he keeps so close. Instead, he smiles kindly, so wide it almost reaches his eyes. Then he bends, kneeling down so he can look Luther in the eye. The boy is transfixed by the sight, overwhelmed not just by the presence of a prince, but by his undivided attention. Your Highness, he squeaks, even trying to salute. At his back, his father is not so proper, and his brow furrows. Silver princes are not his favorite guests. Still, Cal's grin deepens, and his eyes remain on the boy. Please, call me Cal, he says, and extends his hand. Again, Luther pulls away, but Cal doesn't seem to mind. In fact, I'll wager he expected it. Luther flushes, his cheeks pulsing a dark and lovely red. Sorry. Not at all, Cal replies. In fact, I used to do the same thing when I was little. A bit younger than you, but then I had very, very many teachers. I needed them, too, he adds, winking. In spite of his fear, the boy smiles a little. But you just have your dad, don't you? The boy swallows, his tiny throat bobbing. Then he nods. I try, Carver says, again gripping his son's shoulder. We understand, sir, I tell him, more than anyone. Luther nudges Cal with his shoe, his curiosity overcoming all else. What could make you afraid? Before our eyes, Cal's outstretched palm bursts into hot, roiling flame. But it is strangely beautiful, a slow burn of languid, dancing fire, yellow and red, lazy in movement. If not for the heat,
it would seem an artistry instead of a weapon.
I didn't know how to control it, Cal says, letting it play between his fingers. I was afraid of burning people. My father, my friends, my...
His voice almost sticks.
My little brother.
But I learned to make it do as I wished, to keep it from hurting the people I wanted to stay safe. So can you, Luther.
While the boy stares, transfixed, his father is not so certain, but he is not the first parent we faced, and I am prepared for his next question.
What you call new bloods, they can do this too. They can control what they are.
My own hands web with sparks, each one twisting a purple bolt of perfect light. They disappear into my skin, leaving no trace.
Yes, we can, Mr. Carver.
With surprising speed, the man retrieves a pot from a shelf and sets it in front of his son. A plant, maybe a fern, sprouts from the dirt within. Any other would be confused, but Luther knows exactly what his father wants.
Go on, boy,
he prods, his voice kind and gentle.
Show them what needs fixing.
Before I can bristle at the turn of phrase, Luther holds out one trembling hand. His finger grazes the edge of the fern leaf, careful but sure. Nothing happens.
It's okay, Luther, Mr. Carver says. You can let them see.
The boy tries again, his brow furrowing in concentration. This time, he takes the fern by the stem, holding it in his small fist. And slowly, the fern curls beneath his touch, turning black, folding into itself, dying. As we watch, transfixed, Mr. Carver grabs something else from the back shelf and sets it in his son's lap. Leather gloves.
You take good care of him, he says, his teeth clench, shutting tight against the storm inside his heart. You promise me that.
Like all true men, he doesn't flinch when I shake his hand.
I give you my word, Mr. Carver.
Only when we're back at the safe house, which we're starting to call the Notch, do I allow myself a moment alone. To think, to tell myself the lie was well made. I cannot truly promise this boy, or the others like him, will survive what is to come. But I certainly hope he does, and I will do everything I can to make it so. Even if this boy's terrifying ability is death itself.
The New Bloods families aren't the only ones to flee. The measures have made life worse than ever before, driving many Reds into the forests and frontiers, seeking a place where they won't be worked to death or hanged for stepping out of line. Some come within a few miles of our camp, winding north toward a border already painted with autumn snow. Killorn and Farley want to help them, to give them food or medicine, but Cal and I overrule their pleas. No one can know about us, and the Reds marching on are no different, despite their fate. They will keep heading north until they meet the Lakelander border. Some will be pressed into the legions holding the line. Others might be lucky enough to slip through, to succumb to cold and starvation in the tundra rather than a bullet in the trenches. My days blend into each other. Recruitment, training, repeat. All that changes is the weather, as winter grows closer. Now when I wake up, long before dawn, the ground is coated in thick frost. Cal has to heat the air jet himself, freeing wheels and gears coated in ice. Most days he comes with us, flying the jet to whatever new blood we've chosen. But sometimes he stays behind, electing to teach rather than fly. Ada replaces him on those days, and is just as good a pilot as he is, having learned with lightning speed and precision. And her knowledge of Norta, of everything from drainage systems to supply routes, is astounding. I can't begin to fathom how her brain can hold so much, and still have room for so much more.
She is a wonder to me, just like every new blood we find. Almost everyone is different, with strange abilities beyond what any known Silver can do, or what I could even imagine. Luther continues his careful attempts to control his ability, shriveling everything from flowers to saplings. Cal thinks he can use his power to heal himself, but we've yet to find out. Another new blood, an old woman who has everyone call her Nanny, seems to be able to change her physical appearance. She gave us all quite a fright when she decided to waltz through the camp disguised as Queen Alara. Despite her age, I hope to use her in recruitment soon enough. She proves herself as best she can in Cal's training, learning to fire a gun and use a knife with the rest. Of course, this all makes for a very noisy campsite, and would certainly draw notice, even deep in the Great Woods, if not for a woman named Farah, the first recruit after Ada and Nyx, who can manipulate sound itself. She absorbs the explosive blasts of gunfire, smothering each round of bullets so that not even an echo ripples across the valley. As the new bloods expand their abilities, learning to control them as I did, I begin to hope. Cal excels at teaching, especially with the children. They don't have the same prejudices as the older recruits, and take to following him around the camp even when their training lessons are over. This in turn ingratiates the older new bloods to the exiled prince's presence. It's hard to hate Cal when he has children milling around his ankles, begging for another lesson. Even Nyx has stopped glaring at him, though he still refuses to do anything more than grunt in Cal's direction. I'm not so gifted as the exile, and come to dread the morning and late afternoon sessions. I want to blame my unease on exhaustion. Half my days are spent recruiting, traveling to the next name on our list. But that's not it at all. I'm simply a poor instructor. I work closest with a woman named Ketha, whose abilities are more physical and alike to my own. She can't create electricity or any other element, but she can destroy. Like Silver Oblivions, she can explode an object, blowing it apart in a concussive cloud of smoke and fire. But while typical Oblivions are restricted to things they can actually touch, Ketha has no such limitation. She waits patiently, eyeing the rock in my hand. I do my best not to shrink from her explosive gaze, knowing full well what it can do. In the short week since we found her, she's graduated from destroying clumps of paper, leaves, even branches, to solid stone. As with the other new bloods, all they need is a chance to reveal their true selves. The abilities respond in kind, like animals finally let out of their cages. While the others give her training a wide berth, leaving us to the far end of the notch clearing, I can do no such thing. "Control," I say, and she nods. I wish I had more to offer her, but my guidance is woefully poor. I myself have only a month of ability training under my belt, much of it from Julian, who wasn't even a proper trainer to begin with. What's more, it's incredibly personal to me, and I find it difficult to explain exactly what I intend to Ketha. "Control," she repeats. Her eyes narrow, deepening her focus. Strange, her mud-brown eyes are unremarkable, despite the power they hold. Like me, Ketha comes from a river village and could pass for my much older sister or aunt. Her tanned skin and gray-tipped hair are firm reminders of our humble, unjust origins. According to her records, she was a schoolteacher. When I heave the rock skyward, tossing it as far up as I can, I'm reminded of Instructor Arvin in training. He made us hit targets with our abilities, honing our aim and focus. And in the bowl of bones, I became his target. He nearly killed me, and yet here I am, copying his methods. It feels wrong, but effective. The rock pulverizes into dust, as if a tiny bomb went off inside it. Ketha claps for herself, and I force myself to do the same. I wonder if she'll feel differently when her abilities are put to the test, against flesh instead of stone. I suppose I can have Killorn catch us a rabbit so we can find out. But he grows more distant with every passing day.
He's taken it upon himself to feed the camp and spends most of his time fishing or hunting. If I were not so preoccupied with my own duties, recruiting and training, I would try and snap him out of it. But I barely have time to sleep, let alone coax Killorn back into the fold. By the first snowfall, there are 20 new bloods living at the camp, varying from old maids to twitching young boys. Luckily, the safe house is bigger than I first thought, stretching back into the hill in a maze of chambers and tunnels. A few have shafted windows, but most are dark, and we end up having to steal lanterns as well as new bloods from every place we visit. By the time the first snow falls, the Notch sleeps all 26 of us comfortably, with room for more. Food is plentiful, thanks to Killorn and Farah, who turns him into a silent, deadly hunter. Supplies come in with each wave of recruits, ranging from winter clothes to matches and even a bit of salt. Farley and Krantz use their criminal ties to get us what we need, but sometimes we resort to good old-fashioned thievery. In a month's time, we are a well-oiled, well-hidden machine. Maven has not found us, and we keep tabs on him as best we can. Signposts and newspapers make it easy. The king visits Delphi. King Maven and Lady Evangeline review soldiers at Fort Lancaster. Coronation tour continues through the king state. The headlines pinpoint his location, and we know what each of them means. Dead new bloods in Delphi, in Lancaster, in every place he visits. His so-called coronation tour is just another shroud of secrecy, hiding a parade of executions. Despite all our abilities and tricks, we are not fast enough to save everyone. For every new blood we discover and bring back to our camp, there are two more hanging from gallows, missing or bleeding into gutters. A few bodies show the telltale signs of death by Magnetron, skewered or strangled by iron rods. Ptolemus, no doubt. Though Evangeline might be there too, basking in the glow of a king. She'll be queen soon enough, and will certainly do best to keep Maven close. Once that would infuriate me, but now I feel nothing but pity for the Magnetron girl. Maven is not Cal, and he will kill her if it suits him. Just like the new bloods, dead to keep his lies alive, to keep us on the run. Dead, because Maven has miscalculated. He believes enough corpses will make me come back. But I will not. 19. After 3 days of finding nothing but dead new bloods, 3 days of failure, we travel to Templin, a quiet town on the road to Delphi, mostly residential, consisting of vast silver estates and cramped red row houses along the river. Masters and servants. Templin is tricky. It has no vast forest, tunnels, or crowded streets to hide in. Usually we'd use shade to slip inside the walls, but he's not with us today. He twisted his leg yesterday, aggravating a still-healing muscle, and I made him stay behind. Cal is missing too, having elected to teach, leaving Ada to man the black run. She's still there, cozy in her pilot seat, reading as she always does. I try to not be jumpy, to lead as Cal would, but I feel strangely bare without him and my brother. I've never been without both of them on a recruitment mission, and this is my proving ground. To show the others that I'm not only a weapon to be unleashed, but someone willing to fight with them. Luckily, we have a staggering new advantage. A new blood named Harrick, saved from the quarry pits of Orion Protus 2 weeks ago. This will be his first recruitment, and hopefully uneventful. The man is mousy and twitching, with the wiry muscles of a stonemason. Farley and I make sure to flank him in the cart, quietly watchful in case he decides to dart off. The others with us, Nix across from me, and Krantz driving the cart, are more preoccupied with the road ahead. Our cart falls in line with many others. Merchants or laborers heading into the town center for work. Krantz's hands tighten on the reins of our stolen cart horse, an old spotty deer
with a blind eye and a bad hoof. But he urges her forward, keeping pace with the rest, trying to blend in. The town boundaries loom before us, marked by an open gate flanked by intricate stone columns. A flag is strung between them, a familiar banner of a familiar house. Red and orange stripes, almost bleeding together in the early morning light. House Larilan. Oblivions. The governors of the Delphi region. I blink at it, remembering the bodies of three dead Oblivions. Larilans all killed in the shooting at the Hall of the Sun. The father, Bellicose, murdered by Farley and the Scarlet Guard. And his twin sons, barely more than babies, blown to bits by the explosion that followed. Their dead faces were plastered all over the kingdom. In every broadcast, another rallying flag of silver propaganda. The Scarlet Guard kills children. The Scarlet Guard must be destroyed. I glance at Farley, wondering if she knows what the flag means, but she focuses on the officers ahead, as does Herrick. His eyes narrow in concentration and his trembling hands clench. Quietly, I touch his arm, encouraging him. "You can do this," I murmur. He offers me the smallest smile, and I straighten in assurance. I believe in his ability. He's been practicing whenever he can. But he must believe it himself. Nix tenses, muscles bulging beneath his shirt. Farley is less obvious, but I know she's itching for the knife in her boot. I will not show the same fear for Herrick's sake. Security officers man the gate, eyeballing every person who passes through, searching their faces and through their wares, not bothering to check their identification cards. These silvers don't care for what's written on a piece of paper. Their orders are to find me and mine, not a farmer straying too far from his village. Soon our cart is next, and only the sweat on Herrick's upper lip indicates he's doing anything at all. Krantz halts the horse in the cart, stopping at the command of a security officer. He keeps his eyes down, respectful, beaten, as the officer stares at him. As expected, nothing sets him off. Krantz is not a new blood, nor a known associate of ours. Maven will not be hunting him. The officer turns to circle the cart, eyeing the inside. Not one of us dares to move or even breathe. Herrick is not so skilled that he can mask sound, only sight. Once the officer's eyes meet mine, then I wonder if Herrick has failed. But after a heart-stopping moment, he moves on, satisfied. He can't see us. Herrick is a new blood of an extraordinary kind. He can create illusions, mirages, make people see what isn't there. And he has hidden us all in plain sight, making us invisible in our empty cart. "Are you transporting air, Red?" the officer says with a hateful grin. "Collecting shipment, bound for Inadelphi," Krantz replies, saying exactly what Ada told him. She spent yesterday studying trade routes. 1 hour of reading, and she's an expert on the imports and exports of Norda.
"Spun wool, sir."
But the officer is already walking off, unconcerned.
"Move on,"
he says, waving a gloved hand. The cart lurches forward, and Herrick's hand grips mine, squeezing tightly. I squeeze right back, imploring him to hold on, to keep fighting, to keep up his illusion until we're inside Templin and clear of the gate. "One minute more," I whisper. "You're almost there." We turn off the main road before entering the market, weaving through half-empty side streets lined with humble red shops and homes. The others search, knowing what we're looking for, while I keep my attentions on Herrick. "Almost there," I say again, hoping I'm right. In a moment or two, his strength will fail, and our illusion will fall away, revealing us all to the street. The people here are Red, but will certainly report a cart suddenly full of the country's most wanted fugitives.
"Left,"
Nick says gruffly, and Krantz obliges. He eases the cart toward a clapboard house with crimson curtains. Despite the sun shining overhead, a candle burns in the window, red as the dawn.
There's an alleyway next to the house bordered by the Scarlet Guardhouse and two empty abandoned homes. Where their occupants are, I don't know, but they probably fled the measures, over-executed for trying. It's cover enough for me. Now, Herrick, I tell him. He responds with a massive sigh. The protection of his illusion is gone. Well done. We waste no time climbing out of the cart and sidling up to the guardhouse, using the overhang of the roof to hide as best we can. Farley takes the lead and knocks three times on the side door. It opens quickly, showing nothing but darkness beyond. Farley enters without hesitation, and we follow. My eyes adjust quickly to the dark house, and I'm struck by the similarity to my home in the Stilts. Simple, cluttered, only two rooms with knotty plank floors and grimy windows. The light bulbs overhead are dark, either broken or missing, sold off for food.
"Captain,"
a voice says. An older woman, her hair steel gray, appears by the window and snuffs out the candle. Her face is lined with age, her hands with scars, and around her wrist, a familiar tattoo. A single red band, just like the one old Will Whistle bore. As in Harbor Bay, Farley frowns and shakes the woman's hand. "I'm not..." But the woman waves her off.
"According to the colonel, but not command. They have other ideas where you're concerned."
"Command." She notes my interest and bows her head in greeting.
"Miss Barrow, I'm Ellie Whistle."
I raise an eyebrow.
"Whistle?"
I say. "Are you related to..." Ellie cuts me off before I can finish.
"Most likely not. Whistle's a nickname mostly. Means I'm a smuggler. Whistle's on the wind. All of us."
Indeed. Will Whistle and his old wagon were always full of smuggled or stolen goods. Many of them things I brought myself.
"I'm Scarlet Guard, too,"
she adds. I knew that, at least. Farley's been in contact with her people over the last few weeks, those not under the command of the colonel, who would help us and keep our movements quiet. "Very good," I tell her. "We're here for the Marcher family. Two of them, to be precise. Tansy and Matrick Marcher. Twins, judging by their birthdays. They'll need to be removed from town, within the hour if possible." Ellie listens intently, all business. She shifts, and I catch a glimpse of the pistol at her hip. She glances at Farley, and when she nods her head, Ellie does the same.
"That I can do."
"Supplies as well," Farley puts in. "We'll take food if you got it, but winter clothes will be best." Another nod.
"We'll certainly try," Ellie says.
"I'll have whatever we can give you ready as fast as possible. Might need an extra pair of hands, though."
"I've got it," Krantz offers. His bulk will certainly help speed the process. I can't believe Ellie's willingness, and neither can Farley. We exchange loaded glances as Ellie gets to work, opening cabinets and floorboards in succession, revealing hidden compartments all over the house.
"Thank you for your cooperation,"
Farley says over her shoulder, quietly suspicious. As am I, watching every move Ellie makes. She's old but spry, and I wonder if we're truly alone in this house.
"Like I said, I take my orders from command, and they sent out the word. Help Captain Farley and the Lightning Girl, no matter the cost," she says, not bothering to look at us.
My eyebrows rise, shocked and pleasantly surprised. "You're going to have to fill me in on this," I mutter to Farley. Again, I'm struck by how organized and deep-rooted the Scarlet Guard seems to be.
"Later," she replies.
"The Marcher family?" While Ellie gives her directions, I move to stand with Herrick and Nix. Though this is Herrick's first recruitment, Nix thinks this is old hat, and rightfully so. I've lost count of how many times he's accompanied me into hostile territory, and for that I'm so grateful.
"Ready, boys?"
I ask, flexing my fingers.
Nix does his best to look gruff and nonchalant, a veteran of our missions, but I don't miss the flash of fear in Herrick's eyes.
This won't be as hard as coming in. Less people to hide, and the officers aren't bothered.